Hi, this is Barry Liston, Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. At their best, math models can provide essential information for making important decisions in business, government, and our personal lives. At their worst, they can lead to wrong choices that have serious consequences. In today's segment, we talk to Scott Patterson, a former Wall Street Journal reporter and author of The Quants, which is published by Crown Business. The subtitle of his book is How a New Breed of Math Whizzes Conquered Wall Street and Nearly Destroyed It. Scott, welcome to The Science of Better.
Thanks for having me.
In the wake of the recession that began a couple years ago, there's been focus on many aspects of the collapse. Subprime mortgages, the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, the failure to heed profits, if you can call them that, like Brooksley Bourne, who called for regulating derivatives, which brings us to the role of people who do math modeling and financial engineering, the Wunderkind in your book, The Quants. What led you to focus on them?
I started noticing in mid to late 2007 that these mathematically inclined investing folks on Wall Street were having a lot of problems. Initially, this came to my attention when a series of quant-driven hedge funds in August 2007 simultaneously lost billions of dollars, and the sum comes, nobody really knows how much, but it comes to somewhere around $100 billion over the course of about a week was lost by these funds. And these were among the most sophisticated investors in the world. After that, as I started learning more about this world, I realized that quants are everywhere on Wall Street. And when you look at the derivatives world, which was really the ground central of the implosion that wiped out a lot of banks, these are basically computer models. And the whole derivatives universe was created by mathematicians. That's how I got into it, and I saw that there were a lot of parallels between many different quants on Wall Street and the troubles that they were having.
You begin your book at a poker match, and gambling or beating the house comes up frequently throughout the book, including an interesting reference to Liar's Poker, which was the name of Michael Lewis's book about an earlier Wall Street era. Why do these quants obsess about games of chance?
It's the laws of probability, and operations research, one of the founding fathers of OR is John von Neumann, and
right.
One of his first books was about poker and the odds of poker, and that basically set the stage for von Neumann's research into game theory. These are very smart people. Many of them have PhDs in math. They understand these, this deeper world of mathematics and gambling and in poker. And they believe that, practicing it helps make them better traders. And it's also just the kind of people that gravitate to Wall Street. They like to take chances and match themselves up against other people to see how well they can perform. So it's partly the culture, it's partly the kind of people that are drawn to the world, and also the mathematics and the comparisons with what they do every day when they're actually trading.
Were you also pointing out some of the sense that even though they're brilliant, they're kind of just gamblers?
Well, yeah. I've been a reporter who's covered Wall Street for a long time, and it's gambling. I mean, there's no way around it, but when you talk to many market practitioners, they really get offended when you suggest that they're making a bet, and they actually say it's more like they're diversifying their risk, or they come up with all these fancy justifications for why they're doing what they're doing. But at the end of the day, it's gambling, and that's not bad. I'm not making a judgment on gambling. It is a problem when you don't understand the odds, and I think that's one of the biggest problems that happened in recent years, is that these quants and the traders who are using quant formulas became massively overconfident and were massively overbetting. I tried to explain how that's with blackjack. That's something that Ed Thorpe learned long ago when he came up with his card counting strategies when he was an MIT professor. And he was using variations of operations research, actually, and game theory to do that. And he realized that you need to have a very firm understanding of the odds when you're making bets and how the odds can move against you. That's a very simplistic way of saying that these quants lost their ability to recognize the odds and the volatility, you know, in mathematical terms, the volatility that they were betting on the market became far more volatile than they were expecting.
You describe Ed Thorpe as the godfather of the quants. Could you tell us a little bit about his rise, his influence, and the parallel between his theory and the well-known Black-Scholes model?
You know, as I said, he sort of got his start in this world by coming up with a card counting strategy, which he wrote about in a book called Beat the Dealer. And it was very successful. It basically launched a generation of card counters who came to Las Vegas. He kind of got bored with that after he had proven that he could do it and moved on to Wall Street, where he started researching various securities that he believed that he might be able to use his math abilities to invest in. He came upon convertible bonds. These are securities that have a fixed income component and a stock component, essentially, or an option to buy a stock. So you have two pieces, and he was able to see that sometimes the two pieces misalignment. One piece was too expensive and one piece was too cheap. He developed this formula to price convertible bonds, and it was a very similar formula that was devised a number of years later. This was in the mid to late 1960s that Thorpe was doing that. In the early 70s, a number of finance professors, Fisher Black, Myron Scholes, and Robert Merton, came up with a formula called the Black-Scholes option pricing formula, which was essentially the foundation of the quant revolution. It allowed people to price a stock option very accurately. It's basically an option is just, it gives the holder the option to buy or sell a stock at a certain price sometime in the future. That involves some somewhat complicated math in predicting the volatility of a stock and how much it will move over a certain time period.
And Ed Thorpe was doing something very similar, but because he didn't publish, he didn't wind up with the Nobel Prize.
Right. Yeah, well, Thorpe was an investor, so he liked to keep his strategies to himself, even though he did write more than most investors do. And he wrote a little bit about this strategy in that book you referred to, Beat the Market, but he didn't publish the entire formula. These professors published their paper, and you know, like you said, many years later in the late 90s, won the Nobel Prize in Economics for that formula.
I was going to ask what the other quants you profile in this book have in common, but seeing the variety of ways they approach the markets, perhaps you could tell us a little how they are each unique in their efforts to achieve what you describe in marquee letters as the truth.
Okay, so I use this idea of the truth, which actually you will hear some of these quants mention it. They don't really like to go around and talk about it too much, but basically it's this idea that there is a truth or a true nature of markets that can be captured by mathematics and computers, and if you can understand what that formula is, you'll be rich beyond your wildest dreams. So one firm that many people think actually has discovered this truth is called Renaissance Technologies. It's a giant hedge fund based in East Setucket, Long Island, and probably the most successful investing operation of all time in terms of its consistency of returns. Renaissance's Medallion Fund, which has been in operation since the late 80s, has put up annualized returns of about 45% a year, and that is more than double the returns that Warren Buffett has put up in his career.
Yeah, that seems very striking.
Yeah, it's astonishing, actually, and they've never had a down year. They've only had a few down months, actually, in that time period. So their track record is mind-boggling and the envy of the entire quant world. This leads people to believe that they have discovered something about the way the market works. No one really knows exactly what Renaissance does, but it is known pretty widely that they invest very short term. So they make a lot of investments. They trade in and out of stocks and a lot of other securities very rapidly. And their belief is that they think they have an edge over the short term. They discovered many, many years ago that they had the ability to predict where something was going to go in, say, the next hour. Their ability to do that was much higher, much stronger than their ability to predict where something was going to go in the next month or the next year. They realized that if they could just do this over and over again, you will have a statistical edge. That's what Renaissance did, and we live in an age of high-frequency trading, is what a lot of people call it, where firms are trading at rapid paces, measured in millionths of a second, in and out of stocks, and everybody is sort of, in a way, imitating what Renaissance has been doing for many years. But there's others who believe that they've discovered more long-term trends, like Cliff Asness, who runs a big hedge fund called AQR, based in Greenwich, Connecticut. And Cliff was a student at the University of Chicago in the 90s, and he studied under Eugene Fama, who is the creator of the efficient market hypothesis. By studying the inner workings of markets and trends, Asness believed that he had uncovered some trends that you could invest in for the long term. For instance, stocks that have a value stocks that have a low PE ratio or price to earnings ratio, which means they're basically unloved stocks, tend to do better than stocks with a high PE ratio, which generally means they're very popular stocks. So over the long term, if you invest in value stocks and you short growth stocks or sell short expecting to make a profit, you'll do well. He also discovered some momentum trends in the market in which if you invest in a stock that's been going up a lot, the odds are it'll probably keep going for a certain amount of time. Or if you short a stock that's been falling a lot, odds are it'll keep falling. So by using these strategies, Cliff did very well. He initially ran a fund inside Goldman Sachs, the big investment bank, and then launched AQR. And he's had sort of a choppy track record. He did very poorly initially in 99 and 2000 when the dot-com bubble was still inflating. His strategy was basically backwards. Growth stocks were booming and value stocks were tanking. But everything turned around for him, and he did very well for about 6 years. And then when that quant blow-up in August 2007 happened, AQR was really hammered, and it's not done very well in the year since then. And many of these quant strategies have actually struggled for a number of years, sort of casting a lot of doubts on whether this truth that some of them thought they had discovered actually exists. Although Medallion is doing well, so.
Just to backtrack, you described a tremendous financial boom that was happening among the quants in the 1990s in a chapter that you call the money grid. What do you mean by that term, and what was going right in the 1990s?
The money grid is just a term that I created. I have in my mind this vast financial universe that's become connected by computers and all of these formulas, and there is no real name for it. What I was writing about, I thought I should come up with something that I could refer to. So I called it the money grid. And the 90s, you know, is really when computers were becoming more influential in everything in all of our lives. And they also were transforming Wall Street because they gave people the ability to crunch all the numbers and the data that they were able to gather, and there was more data being generated by exchanges and banks were just cranking out all sorts of different kinds of data that these quant firms used and used very effectively. So it was sort of a golden age for quant funds because, you know, at the time there weren't really very many of them. D.E. Shaw was one of them. Renaissance, like I mentioned earlier, AQR came along in the late 90s. So because there were so few firms competing against one another, that meant there were more opportunities. In the 2000s, it became really crowded, and more and more firms started jumping into these strategies and using more leverage to eke out increasingly dwindling returns. And that, in part, is what led to the financial blow-up that we saw in beginning in late 2007.
To look at some of the things that indicated future danger, I remember one leading operations researcher shaking his head in embarrassment and kind of shock when long-term capital management collapsed. Could you give us a quick look at that crisis and also Black Monday, which happened in October 87?
Right. Okay, so I'll start with 87, the Black Monday meltdown in which the Dow Industrial fell 23% in a single day on, I think it was October 19th, was in part or largely created by a quantitative, I guess, strategy, you could call it, called portfolio insurance. And basically, this is something that was created using the Black-Scholes option formula that Wall Street banks sold to large fund managers like pension funds or mutual funds. And it was a form of insurance on a portfolio, largely in the form of S&P futures. So when the market fell, the portfolio insurance holder would short S&P futures, which basically mimicked the S&P 500, and that would minimize your losses. What happened in October 1987 was, as the market started going down, the portfolio insurance holders were shorting the market. That pushed the market down even more, and at a certain point, you reach this sort of terrifying feedback loop that it was sort of a positive feedback loop that was, you know, you push futures down more, you'd sell more futures, pushing down stocks, and it just created a gigantic blow-up. It was really the first quant-created market meltdown. So then again, with long-term capital management, you know, giant hedge fund that was based largely on quantitative strategies using a lot of leverage that also had a connection to Black-Scholes, because Robert Merton and Myron Scholes, two of the creators and the Nobel Prize winners of the Black-Scholes option formula, were part of that hedge fund, and they advised it and invested in it and were partners in long-term capital. They had some very sophisticated risk management strategies at LTCM that were intended to allow the firm to use more leverage by diversifying and basically using very sophisticated methods to manage risk. And I think this is one of the things that led to the blow-up of LTCM, is they believed that they had risk under control. And that led to this massive hubris, really, that allowed the firm to just make bigger and bigger bets. And eventually, when something happened that they weren't expecting and wasn't really in the models, which was in August of 98, Russia defaulted on its debt, and that led to a sort of worldwide flight to safety. And you know, this was something that really turned the models that LTCM was using upside down. And within a matter of weeks, the entire firm went bust, and they lost billions and billions of dollars. And this, again, was sort of a preview into what we've seen recently, because many of the banks used sophisticated risk management strategies that sort of deluded them into believing that they could use a lot more leverage, and, you know, obviously they were wrong about that.
Which I guess brings us to kind of the central chapter in the book, which deals with August 2007. How did everything unravel for the quants at that time, and what was the chain reaction, what you referred to as the August factor?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, they were sort of the canary in the coal mine, in a way, these quant hedge funds that, you know, many of them had not invested at all in the CDOs that were sort of at the heart of the blow-up.
Collateralized debt obligations.
Right, these Right, collateralized debt obligations, which were basically derivatives that were, they were packages of mortgage-backed securities. Most of them were based on subprime mortgages. And yet, these funds were among the first to really melt down. And I think it's because they sort of epitomized, in a way, what Wall Street had become, which was a giant computer-driven quant investing machine. These funds had been competing against each other for years and years. They'd never really seen major losses at all, so they became, you know, much like LTCM, extremely confident in their models and their ability to use leverage. As more funds got into these strategies, they needed to use more leverage to amplify the returns that were sort of, they were dwindling. They had been dwindling in the years leading up to 2007. So nobody really knows, still to this date, knows exactly what happened, but the operating theory is that a large macro hedge fund that held some of these CDOs or some subprime securities was suffering losses and needed to liquidate assets in order to make up for those losses. And the easiest place to liquidate is the stock market. So they told their quant stock fund manager to sell everything and get out. And this, and probably this happened in mid-July of 2007. It created ripples through other quant strategies that forced the other funds to start selling and delevering. And it turned into this sort of out of control machine that was just careering off the road uncontrollably. And the over a period of about 4 days, these firms were just forced to sell like crazy and delever their strategies. And it was something that they'd never seen before. Every model they had was basically operating in reverse, just like with LTCM. So stocks that they had expected to go up were going down, and stocks that they expected to go down were going up. It completely baffled all of them, and eventually things settled down, and they were able to make some of their money back in the following weeks. But one of the reasons I focus on it in the book is because it really was the first crazy thing that happened leading up to the total financial meltdown that we saw in 2008.
Those with the foresight to predict the crash included Nouriel Roubini, who was disparaged as Dr. Doom, and Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who wrote the ominous book, The Black Swan. How did Taleb, Oxford's Paul Wilmot, and another academic, Benoit Mandelbrot, come to warn about the faults in the quant's models?
Well, I guess the first would be Mandelbrot, and a lot of what Taleb says is very similar to what Mandelbrot had discovered decades ago, actually. In the early 60s, he'd written a paper about how cotton prices in reality were far more volatile than the models that a lot of econometricians and other financial modelers at the time were using. So, Mandelbrot wrote this paper, but it was widely disparaged by the academic community and other financial engineers. And he basically was ignored. And, what Taleb learned on his own as a trader and also a mathematician was that markets can make crazy moves. He was actually trading Eurodollar futures contracts in 1987 and on Black Monday. And these Eurodollar contracts are very liquid, and when everybody was afraid and trying to find the most liquid thing they can invest in, they all flooded into Eurodollars, and he made millions of dollars in the blink of an eye on that one day. And it kind of woke him up to the fact that the market can just do crazy things. And he didn't forget that lesson. A lot of people on Wall Street just said, "Well, this is a freak event. It'll never happen again." And the modeler said, something like Black Monday was so unlikely that it couldn't happen. And, if the universe had existed seven times more than the length of its own history, this event still couldn't happen, according to our models. So what Taleb said was that the models, throw the models out. They don't work. Wilmot is a financial engineer. He actually started up the financial engineering course at Oxford University. And he doesn't say throw the models out, but he does say make them a lot less complicated and think about volatility in the way that a real trader would. You know, don't make crazy bets. Be very careful about what you're doing. And the world can turn on a dime. And that's something I think that a lot of quants are learning now, hopefully, is that they need to be more connected to how markets actually work. And I've talked to a lot of guys who came up in this world, and they, you know, many of them got their start as a trader, somebody who was trading in the pits in Chicago, or actually managed real money, and then they were mathematically gifted, so they moved on to the world of quantitative finance. They saw this whole world sort of going off the edge because many people were coming into Wall Street who had been trained in universities in mathematical finance but had never actually traded, and they didn't understand that the models can, you know, get it wrong a lot. So I think maybe, you know, after the experience of the past few years, you know, we have a new generation that's learned that, and hopefully they won't make the same mistakes all over again.
We only have time for a couple more questions. In Free Fall, Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz criticized banking and, by extension, Wall Street because it wasn't adding social value. It no longer fulfilled its traditional role of helping build factories and underwrite new business. Did the quants in your book do anything for the economy other than enrich themselves and bring the house down?
It's a difficult question because, you know, I think there is something to be said for making markets more efficient. And, you know, the argument can be made that some of the activities of these firms do make markets more efficient because the models are, they're seeing, they can see how the market has been working for many years and in a way maybe how the market should work. When you bring securities, there should be in alignment, back into alignment, that in a way is making it more efficient. But, you know, everything got so far out of control, and the devastation that we're seeing now is, it's reaping a huge amount of damage on society. And as I believe and argue in this book, a lot of it is because of these quantitative methods that inundated Wall Street on every level that you can think of. So the answer to that remains to be seen, because maybe they can come up with ways of helping solve the problems that they've created. And you know, I don't believe that everything happened was the result of quantitative formulas. You know, that's the focus of my book, and that's what I sort of harp upon. But there were other things going on, obviously. People were buying houses they couldn't afford, and that's not something that the quants, they didn't convince people to do that. I do believe that the appetite of Wall Street for these mortgages drove that kind of behavior, but I don't know. It's a difficult question, and I don't think that when it comes between Wilmot, should we use financial engineering, or Taleb, throw it all out. I sort of fall more on Wilmot's side, that we need people that can use math to trade and price securities that are complicated. But they also need to understand that the models don't always capture all of the risk, and we basically need to keep the leverage under control.
That's all the time we have today. We've been talking with Scott Patterson, author of The Quants, which is published by Crown Business. Scott, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Science of Better podcast by INFORMS, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.